The audible of the best in Bitcoin. This is the Cryptoconomy. What is up, my fellow sat stackers? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy, to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. A shout out to our boys over at Swan Bitcoin, the true Bitcoiners providing the Bitcoin-only savings plan to auto-DCA and auto-withdraw to your own keys. You got to check them out at swanbitcoin.com. Today, we are officially getting into Anatomy of the State by Murray Rothbard. Now, something as we jump into this piece here, it'll take at least 2 days, maybe three, it depends. One thing I just want to keep in mind, an idea that I want you to hold as we start into this piece, is that all of these things, the state itself, the government, these things are social constructs. And I kind of hate that term sometimes, so forgive me for using it. But I want to remind you that all of this is simply things that we believe, and therefore we act upon these beliefs. Understand, there's not actually something called the government. Like, you can't point at a thing that is the government. Like, I can point at and say, this is my car, and this is a car. Like, and I can explain to you what it is, how it works, and it's a thing in the real world that does something. Government isn't, you can't point at like a building and be like, that's the government, because the government could just move to another building. The government is literally just a bunch of people who we respond to differently, that we have a set idea about what they are allowed to do and that we follow what they say because of it. It's a hierarchy of authority, but it is 100% just exists in everybody's mind at the same time. Like, if the police didn't believe it, the police wouldn't enforce it. It wouldn't exist. Like if you just started going up the ladder, if everyone didn't agree that this was a thing, it genuinely wouldn't exist. Now, that's not to say that, you know, it's inherently not useful, or that it's like that's not an argument about the practicality of a government or institutions in general, because this is true of all institutions. It's also true of just normal behavior. When you go into like a lecture or something, you can generally expect that the person next to you will be clothed. They won't be screaming at the top of their lungs for the entire lecture. That, you know, people won't be having their own conversations. Like, that there's a very strict set of behaviors that everybody is basically on the same page about, so you can actually go and share this event and this experience together, because they're very strict ideas about what you can and cannot do. But I just want to get in your mind before we jump into this piece that this is all 100% a set of beliefs about authority. The government genuinely only exists inside of everyone's heads. Outside of that, it's just the same people, the same buildings, the same tools, the same cars, the same everything that makes up all the other stuff. It's indistinguishable from the physical realm. It is only inside the human mind that it actually exists. So with that little introduction here, let's go ahead and jump into Murray Rothbard's Anatomy of the State. The greatest danger to the state is independent intellectual criticism. Murray N. Rothbard. What the state is not. The state is almost universally considered an institution of social service. Some theorists venerate the state as the apotheosis of society. Others regard it as an amiable, though often inefficient, organization for achieving social ends. But almost all regard it as a necessary means for achieving the goals of mankind. A means to be ranged against the private sector, and often winning in this competition of resources. With the rise of democracy, the identification of the state with society has been redoubled, until it is common to hear sentiments expressed which violate virtually every tenet of reason and common sense, such as, we are the government. The useful collective term, we, has enabled an ideological camouflage to be thrown over the reality of political life. If, quote, we are the government, then anything a government does to an individual is not only just and untyrannical, but also voluntary on the part of the individual concerned. If the government has incurred a huge public debt, which must be paid by taxing one group for the benefit of another, this reality of burden is obscured by saying that, quote, we owe it to ourselves. If the government conscripts a man or throws him into jail for dissident opinion, then he is doing it to himself, and therefore nothing untoward has occurred. Under this reasoning, any Jews murdered by the Nazi government were not murdered. Instead, they must have committed suicide, since they were the government, which was democratically chosen, and therefore anything the government did to them was voluntary on their part. One would not think it necessary to belabor this point, and yet the overwhelming bulk of the people hold this fallacy to a greater or lesser degree. We must therefore emphasize that we are not the government. The government is not us. The government does not, in any accurate sense, represent the majority of the people. But even if it did, even if 70% of the people decided to murder the remaining 30%, this would still be murder and would not be voluntary suicide on the part of the slaughtered minority. No organicist metaphor, no irrelevant bromide that, quote, we are all part of one another, must be permitted to obscure this basic fact. If then the state is not us, if it is not the human family getting together to decide mutual problems, if it is not a lodge meeting or country club, what is it? Briefly, the state is that organization in society which attempts to maintain a monopoly of the use of force and violence in a given territorial area. In particular, it is the only organization in society that obtains its revenue not by voluntary contribution or payment for services rendered, but by coercion. While other individuals or institutions obtain their income by production of goods and services and by the peaceful and voluntary sale of these goods and services to others, the state obtains its revenue by the use of compulsion, that is, by the use and the threat of the jailhouse and the bayonet. Having used force and violence to obtain its revenue, the state generally goes on to regulate and dictate the other actions of its individual subjects. One would think that simple observation of all states through history and over the globe would be proof enough of this assertion. But the miasma of myth has lain so long over state activity that elaboration is necessary. What the state is. Man is born naked into the world, and needing to use his mind to learn how to take the resources given him by nature and to transform them, for example, by investment in capital, into shapes and forms and places where the resources can be used for the satisfaction of his wants and the advancement of his standard of living. The only way by which man can do this is by the use of his mind and energy to transform resources or production and to exchange these products for products created by others. Man has found that, through the process of voluntary mutual exchange, the productivity and hence the living standards of all participants in exchange may increase enormously. The only natural course for man to survive and to attain wealth, therefore, is by using his mind and energy to engage in the production and exchange process. He does this first by finding natural resources and then by transforming them, by mixing his labor with them, as Locke puts it, to make them his individual property, and then by exchanging this property for the similarly obtained property of others. The social path dictated by the requirements of man's nature, therefore, is the path of property rights and the free market of gift or exchange of such rights. Through this path, men have learned how to avoid the jungle methods of fighting over scarce resources so that A can only acquire them at the expense of B, and instead to multiply those resources enormously in peaceful and harmonious production and exchange. The great German sociologist Franz Oppenheimer pointed out that there are two mutually exclusive ways of acquiring wealth. One, the above way of production and exchange, he called the economic means. The other way is simpler in that it does not require productivity. It is the way of seizure of another's goods or services by the use of force and violence. This is the method of one-sided confiscation, of theft of the property of others. This is the method which Oppenheimer termed the political means to wealth. It should be clear that the peaceful use of reason and energy in production is the natural path for man, the means for his survival and prosperity on earth. It should be equally clear that the coercive, exploitive means is contrary to natural law. It is parasitic, for instead of adding to production, it subtracts from it. The political means siphons production off to a parasitic and destructive individual or group, and this siphoning not only subtracts from the number producing, but also lowers the producer's incentive to produce beyond his own subsistence. In the long run, the robber destroys his own subsistence by dwindling or eliminating the source of his own supply. But not only that, even in the short run, the predator is acting contrary to his own true nature as a man. We are now in a position to answer more fully the question, what is the state? The state, in the words of Oppenheimer, is the organization of the political means. It is the systematization of the predatory process over a given territory. For crime, at best, is sporadic and uncertain. The parasitism is ephemeral, and the coercive parasitic lifeline may be cut off at any time by the resistance of the victims. The state provides a legal, orderly, systematic channel for the predation of private property. It renders certain, secure, and relatively, quote, peaceful, the lifeline of the parasitic caste in society. Since production must always precede predation, the free market is anterior to the state. The state has never been created by a, quote, social contract. It has always been born in conquest and exploitation. The classic paradigm was a conquering tribe pausing in its time-honored method of looting and murdering a conquered tribe to realize that the time span of plunder would be longer and more secure and the situation more pleasant if the conquered tribe were allowed to live and produce with the conquerors settling among them as rulers, exacting a steady annual tribute. One method of the birth of a state may be illustrated as follows. In the hills of southern Ruritania, a bandit group manages to obtain physical control over the territory, and finally, the bandit chieftain proclaims himself king of the sovereign and independent government of South Ruritania. And if he and his men have the force to maintain this rule for a while, lo and behold, a new state has joined the family of nations, and the former bandit leaders have been transformed into the lawful nobility of the realm. How the state preserves itself. Once a state has been established, the problem of the ruling group, or caste, is how to maintain their rule. While force is their modus operandi, their basic and long-run problem is ideological. For in order to continue in office, any government, not simply a democratic government, must have the support of the majority of its subjects. This support, it must be noted, need not be active enthusiasm. It may well be passive resignation, as if to an inevitable law of nature. But support in the sense of acceptance of some sort it must be. Else the minority of state rulers would eventually be outweighed by the active resistance of the majority of the public. Since predation must be supported out of the surplus of production, it is necessarily true that the class constituting the state, the full-time bureaucracy and nobility, must be a rather small minority in the land, although it may, of course, purchase allies among important groups in the population. Therefore, the chief task of the rulers is always to secure the active or resigned acceptance of the majority of the citizens. Of course, one method of securing support is through the creation of vested economic interests. Therefore, the king alone cannot rule. He must have a sizable group of followers who enjoy the prerequisites of rule. For example, the members of the state apparatus, such as the full-time bureaucracy or the established nobility. But this still secures only a minority of eager supporters, and even the essential purchasing of support by subsidies and other grants of privilege still does not obtain the consent of the majority. For this essential acceptance, the majority must be persuaded by ideology that their government is good, wise, and at least inevitable, and certainly better than other conceivable alternatives. Promoting this ideology among the people is the vital social task of the, quote, intellectuals. For the masses of men do not create their own ideas, or indeed think through these ideas independently. They follow passively the ideas adopted and disseminated by the body of intellectuals. The intellectuals are, therefore, the, quote, opinion molders in society. And since it is precisely a molding of opinion that the state most desperately needs, the basis for age-old alliance between the state and the intellectuals becomes clear. It is evident that the state needs the intellectuals. It is not so evident why intellectuals need the state. Put simply, we may state that the intellectual's livelihood in the free market is never too secure. For the intellectual must depend on the values and choices of the masses of his fellow men. And it is precisely characteristic of the masses that they are generally uninterested in intellectual matters. The state, on the other hand, is willing to offer the intellectuals a secure and permanent berth in the state apparatus, and thus a secure income and the panoply of prestige. For the intellectuals will be handsomely rewarded for the important function they perform for the state rulers, of which group they now become a part. The alliance between the state and the intellectuals was symbolized in the eager desire of professors at the University of Berlin in the 19th century to form the, quote, intellectual bodyguard of the House of Hohenzollern. In the present day, let us note the revealing comment of an eminent Marxist scholar concerning Professor Wittfogel's critical study of ancient Oriental despotism. Quote, "The civilization which Professor Wittfogel is so bitterly attacking was one which could make poets and scholars into officials." End quote. Of innumerable examples, we may cite the recent development of the, quote, "science of strategy," in the service of the government's main violence-wielding arm, the military. A venerable institution, furthermore, is the official or, quote, court historian, dedicated to purveying the rulers' views of their own and their predecessors' actions. Many and varied have been the arguments by which the state and its intellectuals have induced their subjects to support their rule. Basically, the strands of argument may be summed up as follows. A. The state rulers are great and wise men. They, quote, rule by divine right. They are, quote, the aristocracy of men. They are the scientific experts, much greater and wiser than the good but rather simple subjects. And B, rule by the extent government is inevitable, absolutely necessary, and far better than the indescribable evils that would ensue upon its downfall. The union of church and state was one of the oldest and most successful of these ideological devices. The ruler was either anointed by God, or in the case of the absolute rule of many Oriental despotisms, was himself God. Hence, any resistance to his rule would be blasphemy. The state's priestcraft performed the basic intellectual function of obtaining popular support and even worship for the rulers. Another successful device was to instill fear of any alternative systems of rule or non-rule. The present rulers, it was maintained, supply to the citizens an essential service for which they should be most grateful: protection against sporadic criminals and marauders. For the state, to preserve its own monopoly of predation, did indeed see to it that private and unsystematic crime was kept at a minimum. the state has always been jealous of its own preserve. Especially has the state been successful in recent centuries in instilling the fear of other state rulers, since the land area of the globe has been parceled out among particular states. One of the basic doctrines of the state was to identify itself with the territory it governed. Since most men tend to love their homeland, the identification of the land and its people with the state was a means of making natural patriotism work to the state's advantage. If, quote, Ruritania was being attacked by, quote, Waldavia, the first task of the state and its intellectuals was to convince the people of Ruritania that the attack was really upon them and not simply upon the ruling caste. In this way, a war between rulers was converted into a war between peoples, with each people coming to the defense of its rulers in the erroneous belief that the rulers were defending them. This device of, quote, nationalism has only been successful in Western civilization in recent centuries. It was not too long ago that the mass of subjects regarded wars as irrelevant battles between various sets of nobles. Many and subtle are the ideological weapons that the state has wielded through the centuries. One excellent weapon has been tradition. The longer that the rule of the state has been able to preserve itself, the more powerful this weapon. For then, the X dynasty, or the Y state, has the seeming weight of centuries of tradition behind it. Worship of one's ancestors, then, becomes a non-too-subtle means of worship of one's ancient rulers. The greatest danger to the state is independent intellectual criticism. There is no better way to stifle that criticism than to attack any isolated voice, any raiser of new doubts, as a profane violator of the wisdom of his ancestors. Another potent ideological force is to deprecate the individual and exalt the collectivity of society. For since any given rule implies majority acceptance, any ideological danger to that rule can only start from one or a few independently thinking individuals. The new idea, much less the new critical idea, must needs begin as a small minority opinion. Therefore, the state must nip the view in the bud by ridiculing any view that defies the opinions of the mass. Quote, listen only to your brothers, or quote, adjust to society, thus becomes ideological weapons for crushing individual dissent. By such measures, the masses will never learn of the non-existence of their emperor's clothes. It is also important for the state to make its rule seem inevitable. Even if its reign is disliked, it will then be met with passive resignation, as witness the familiar coupling of, quote, death and taxes. One method is to induce historiographical determinism, as opposed to individual freedom of will. If the X dynasty rules us, this is because the inexorable laws of history, or the divine will, or the absolute, or the material productive forces, have so decreed, and nothing any puny individuals may do can change the inevitable decree. It is also important for the state to inculcate in its subjects an aversion to any, quote, conspiracy theory of history. For a search for conspiracies means a search for motives and an attribution of responsibility for historical misdeeds. If, however, any tyranny imposed by the state, or venality, or aggressive war, was caused not by the state rulers, but by mysterious and arcane social forces, or by the imperfect state of the world, or if in some way everyone was responsible, we are all murderers, proclaims one slogan, then there is no point to the people becoming indignant or rising up against such misdeeds. Furthermore, an attack on conspiracy theories means that the subjects will become more gullible in believing the general welfare reasons that are always put forth by the state for engaging in any of its despotic actions. A conspiracy theory can unsettle the system by causing the public to doubt the state's ideological propaganda. Another tried and true method for bending subjects to the state's will is inducing guilt. Any increase in private well-being can be attacked as unconscionable greed, materialism, or excessive affluence. Profit-making can be attacked as exploitation and usury. mutually beneficial exchanges denounced as selfishness, and somehow with the conclusion always being drawn that more resources should be siphoned from the private to the public sector. The induced guilt makes the public more ready to do just that. For while individual persons tend to indulge in, quote, selfish greed, the failure of the state's rulers to engage in exchanges is supposed to signify their devotion to higher and nobler causes, parasitic predation being apparently morally and aesthetically lofty as compared to peaceful and productive work. In the present more secular age, the divine right of the state has been supplemented by the invocation of a new god, science. State rule is now proclaimed as being ultra-scientific, as constituting planning by experts. But while, quote, reason is invoked more than in previous centuries, this is not the true reason of the individual and his exercise of free will. It is still collectivist and determinist, still implying holistic aggregates and coercive manipulation of passive subjects by their rulers. The increasing use of scientific jargon has permitted the state's intellectuals to weave obscurantist apologia for state rule that would have only met with derision by the populace of a simpler age. A robber who justified his theft by saying that he really helped his victims, by his spending giving a boost to retail trade, would find few converts. But when this theory is clothed in Keynesian equations and impressive references to the multiplier effect, it unfortunately carries more conviction. And so the assault on common sense proceeds, each age performing the task in its own ways. Thus, ideological support being vital to the state, it must unceasingly try to impress the public with its legitimacy, to distinguish its activities from those of mere brigands. The unremitting determination of its assaults on common sense is no accident, for as Mencken vividly maintained, quote, "The average man, whatever his errors otherwise, at least sees clearly that government is something lying outside him and outside the generality of his fellow men, that it is a separate, independent, and hostile power, only partly under his control and capable of doing him great harm. Is it a fact of no significance that robbing the government is everywhere regarded as a crime of less magnitude than robbing an individual or even a corporation? What lies behind all this, I believe, is a deep sense of the fundamental antagonism between the government and the people it governs. It is apprehended not as a committee of citizens chosen to carry on the communal business of the whole population, but as a separate and autonomous corporation, mainly devoted to exploiting the population for the benefit of its own members. When a private citizen is robbed, a worthy man is deprived of the fruits of his industry and thrift. When the government is robbed, the worst that happens is that certain rogues and loafers have less money to play with than they had before. The notion that they have earned that money is never entertained. To most sensible men, it would seem ludicrous." End quote. How the state transcends its limits. All right, we're going to cut it off right there for today. It's getting late. Let's go ahead and hit our sponsor, and then I want to talk a little bit about the first half. We're about halfway through here of Anatomy of the State by Murray Rothbard. But real quick, let's hit our sponsor first. All right, so we've gotten through the first half of Anatomy of the State by Murray Rothbard. The resource, by the way, where how I get this and how I get almost everything on economics is Mises.org. Just so you know, like, don't forget for a shout out for these guys for making so much of, just an incredible library of stuff available for free to just peruse and read all of this. So, there's a couple of key takeaways from this. Particularly like my first read through, I don't know how many years ago now, of where he defines like what the state is, what the state is not. One of the key things is the idea of we is simply that we are not the state. And this is such a painfully obvious fact in like retrospect, like in hindsight, when you're looking back, like there could be nothing more clear than the fact that there is the government, there is people who are part of the state, and then there are people who are not part of the state. And these are not in any way one and the same people. And I love his examples there of, you know, like the Jewish people did not commit suicide under the Nazi government. And it's irrelevant that they were democratically chosen. And no matter which way you paint it, or like whatever the degree of damage or looting has been done by one part of the population on another, if even if it's 70%, even if it's 90% of the population that agrees to do something, the other 10% has not done it to themselves. There's just no logic whatsoever in the idea that we are the government. There's a great quote from a novelist or graphic novelist. Her name is weird. I don't know exactly how to pronounce it. It's like Marjane Satrapi or something like that. You may know of Persepolis. There was an animated film about that. Really interesting. But she said in an interview during the Iraq War, she's Iranian, and she talked about in the interview how, like the quote specifically was that there isn't this perceived divide between, you know, Iranians and Americans, but that the difference between you and your government is much larger than the difference between you and me, and that the difference between me and my government is much bigger than the difference between me and you, but that our governments are very much the same. And that's such a great way to kind of illustrate the ridiculousness of the we statement, that we are our government, when in reality there's a clear distinction between two castes, the population or the citizens, and then their government. And the chasm in difference between those two people is much greater than the differences between the normal people from geographic location A, B, C, D, or anywhere in the world. And there's not a whole lot of difference. There's difference in degrees, not kind, between different governments. And you can see very easily our current predicaments being, you know, Exhibit A, how quickly those differences can shift dramatically closer towards each other with very, very little buildup, essentially. If the excuse is there, then there's very little restraint. And this is also, you think about like the device of we are the government, like one of the important things that it can do is that it absolves them of guilt. It absolves the ruling class and the wealthy class, anybody who manipulates or takes advantage of this to create, you know, systemic imbalances or corruption or bribery or wars or any of the, you know, thousands of things that you could list, that it absolves them of guilt. Is that it's like they're including the rest of us in their crimes so that we can't get mad at them. And this is something that people do all the time, right? This is just kind of the natural state of thing. When you kind of just think about this in the context of this is just in people's heads, well, of course they're going to do that. And if they have a loud enough voice, if they can punch that ideological idea into enough people, then it may very well be that they get away with horrible crimes and immoral actions and systems by, you know, it's like we did this to ourselves. The bailouts and the paying each other and the debts, the supposed government debt and all of this nonsense that we owe it to ourselves. That's the craziest thing. It's like, no, A owes it to B, that they happen to be near each other, or that there happen to be under the same hierarchy of thing, does not mean that B doesn't owe it to A. Like, if I owe something, if the government owes me something, I'm not, you, like, these resources come from somewhere. Someone is paying the price. Like, think about it in the context of, like, the job market right now. Like, what is it, like, up to 26 million people have filed for unemployment. Think about how crazy that is. That, I mean, that's almost 10% of the entire population, not the working population, of everybody. And how much of that is the government sharing? How much of that are people in the wealthy class that are connected to the government? How many of that is government employees? How many of that is in the subsidies and the grants that the government has used to pay off people and the contracts? How many of them are having to cut back? Well, it necessarily means that the rest of us are paying for it. And the problem is we think this is all being covered up by money. When the reality of it is the government has gotten so big, the predation of the population has gotten so out of control. And then with the full economic shutdown that we've had, there's not going to be anything left to siphon off in order to prop this thing up. There has to be real production and real goods to steal the value of. And that's where the second major point of this is in Oppenheimer's two methods of obtaining goods, of obtaining productive goods. And there are literally only two, is the economic means and the political means. And that distinction is critical because the economic means is literally to produce it, to earn it yourself, to go out and find it, to trade it with somebody else, to actually cooperate and to construct, to build, to add to the productive pool of resources, to create something new in the world that would make standard of living's rise, or standards of living rise, and to provide extra benefit or time savings or a service or entertainment or whatever it is to another person in the economy or to yourself. You know, you can produce just for yourself. But the political means is to explicitly, like, the difference is literally just that one is not earned, is that there you can coerce, you can rob, you can threaten, and you can take it. And no matter what you do, no matter how much you try to cover it up, no matter how much you try to limit it or try to say that, oh, there's some perceived benefit because it, you know, broke up this trust or, you know, these monopolies, like whatever you want to call it. In the end, any amount of resources or power, anything allocated by that institution is necessarily an allocation towards something that does not produce away from the people who do earn and produce. That's why people fight all the time and they debate over which way the government should get bigger, when any dollar that the government gets bigger is a removal of that from the economic means of resource allocation, of cooperating with each other, and the addition of the parasitic means with which we deal with each other. And it doesn't matter which direction or how or what contract you stick on it or how many times you spin it and flip it over. It doesn't. It's the exact same thing no matter what. The fundamental problem is still the fact that you are using resource allocation from a means of confiscation, from a parasitic means, explicitly through action which does not add any productive good or value to the economy, but instead steals from and disincentivizes the people who are producing and are adding value. And think about it, as soon as you stopped doing that, as soon as they actually earn or actually trade value for value, it's no longer a political means. It's a trade. It's an exchange on the free market. The second they say, you know, someone denies that trade and they put a gun to their head, or they say, we're going to put you in jail, or we're going to threaten you, well, it immediately becomes the obvious reality that they've not produced of equal value because the person doesn't want to trade. As soon as they aren't including violence and coercion, it's just no longer the political means. It's no longer part of the state. It's a voluntary trade between two people. And another thing that he kind of talks about, like, during this section was in explaining how it was that the ruling class, the government, to kind of demonstrate essentially that it is obviously and clearly a parasitic thing, is to just show why it can't actually grow. Like it can't grow beyond a certain point, because if it gets too large, it necessarily collapses and kills the very thing which it is a parasite of. So, like, you could grow the market economy, you could grow cooperation and free trade as much as you wanted, and there's not, like, a point where it collapses. But if you grow the state, like, it necessarily has to be a small, wealthy, ruling class, because otherwise, there's nothing to actually, there's no added benefit to it. There's no way to, because it's parasitic, it must be a minority. It must be a small group of people because, you know, if the parasite is as big as the host, well, then the host simply dies. That's why it always ends up with, you know, these sections of the economy, these, the wealthy class that are bought off and, you know, get to live off the spoils of the parasite. Then you've got this whole second class that's this next set of people who are just waiting to get their, you know, the crumbs that are left over, the next in line to get that benefit. And then you get the bulk of people that are like kind of just passively resigned to the fact that this is a reality and that there's no escaping it, that we just have this ruling class and it would be way, way worse if we didn't have it. And then you have the very last, you know, small group of people who see it for what it is or just resign themselves to the fact that they can't do anything about it. And we see that all the time, right? Like, there's only so far that the government can actually employ people before the society is getting poorer. And like when you create these imbalances where, you know, they're siphoning value from the savers of the economy, from the actual producers, I think what we've got, I mean, if you look at the amount of government involvement, direction and expenditure as part of the economy, even if you're comparing it, like look at the charts of, as a percentage of GDP, and as we've gone over very recently in This Is Not Capitalism, GDP is a horrible, horrible measure. You can actually have productivity and standard of livings fall across the board, but still give the illusion, you can still have a growing GDP because you're making nominal measurements, not qualitative measurements. And if, you know, you print money, if somebody wins out, like if the banks make a ton of money at the expense of everybody else, it might be that the standard of living fell across the board, but if the banks make enough money, if they siphon enough out and their stocks go up and everybody invested in them, their cronies go up, well, then it can actually be that GDP rose because, you know, they printed money, they were able to get loans that didn't exist. In other words, from capital that didn't exist, then you're literally measuring inflation and the amount of new money created at a lot of the junctures that were supposedly measuring productivity. But we did a whole episode on that one, so I won't go too far back into that. But even if you compare it to that, which is a bad measurement, the amount that the government has spent, the amount that of our economy that the government now directs, that is used by the political means, or is allocated by political means rather than the economic means, has grown steadily. And in that same way, what they've done is they've papered over this imbalance. They've tried to convince us that we're healthy, even though the parasite is consuming more and more, and we're reaching a tipping point now where, because the parasite cannot be cut, because the parasite doesn't get smaller. When there's 30% unemployment, it's 30% of the private sector. Nobody gets fired from government because they have an endless pool of resources because it comes from the rest of us. When that happens, there will be a tipping point where none of it can actually be sustained anymore, where the only way to keep the parasite alive is to kill its host. But therein is why pressures get so bad. You get civil unrest, you get riots, you get the breakdown of the entire structure of the system, because it breaks down the ideology that there's any perceived benefit whatsoever from this. And again, you see this in the bailouts, like going back to the idea that there needs to be a minority of people benefiting from this, to a great degree because it's a non-productive means to allocate wealth. It's impossible for it to be a majority of the people who benefit. You see that in how they bail things out. They only bail out the wealthy because they're the ones that they need to the people who control the platforms, the people who, you know, control the schools. That's why schools are one of the first things that a state considers absolutely critical, because how dangerous and stupid and terrible would it be if we had people learning things other than the ideology that the state believes, other than, you know, putting their hand over their heart and saying, we are the government and we are the people and this is our country and we are all in this geographical area and anything that our government does is our guilt. And that, you know, we are all in this together. We have to pump that into people's heads because it makes good soldiers. You know, that's where the Prussian school system originated. That's what its original design was. I don't know if anybody has actually dug into the history of the school system, but what we did is we copied the Prussian school system, the one that led to Nazi Germany. And it was explicitly because in the incredible literature about this school system, it was created in order to stamp out people's autonomy. Literally, the excuse, the reasoning was that we can't have soldiers running away thinking of their lives rather than the needs of the state. It was a schooling system, nothing about it was about education. It was about creating obedience and, of course, teaching an ideology. Make sure that everyone believes in the necessity, the inevitability of this authority hierarchy, that everyone plays along either through passive resignation or active benefit and will pay off the people that are really important to pay off, will give huge bailouts to the wealthy class because they're clearly the most influential, the celebrity class because they spread the ideology as far as possible. And of course, the intellectual class, the schooling and the education, because they've got, you know, get people when they're young. If you can get them when they're 5 years old and you know, beat the same idea, it doesn't matter what else you teach them anything else. It doesn't, who cares? Just as long as you've got that one message about the greatness of all of our leaders and that the story of history is the story of governments and nothing else. It's, you know, make sure everybody cares about who the president was and which war we did. That these are the important pieces of history that need to be focused on, and everything else, all like private things don't matter. In fact, the only times private things are brought up are when one company did something bad and they needed to, the government came in and saved us, or, the evil industry and everything, we're putting kids to work and the government came in and saved us. And this creates one of the most insidious and backwards thinking of, which is so common. I mean, I even find it in Bitcoiners. Like, I mean, this is so deep that it's even hard to get around in almost anyone. I even fall into this same like pattern of thinking sometimes. But the idea that the market to cooperate, to trade, that is the selfish thing. It's so deeply ingrained in everyone that it's not even challenged if it is ever brought up, that the idea of making profit is evil. The idea to realize make a profit means that you produced more value than you consumed. You make a profit when you go to work, get paid, and come home because you didn't blow all your money before you got home. You produced value and you didn't destroy it all immediately. But that everything in the private sector is the evil, the selfish, the self-centered part of human interaction. And that's the evil part of the economy. But but the predators, the parasites, they are there. The reason they don't exchange is because their intentions are so good. Their intentions are so angelic. Not only just like a little bit different from their counterparts in the private sector, or maybe they were in the private sector CEO of some corporation last year, but now that they are part of the government, not only is it that it's not selfish, it's so altruistic and so good and just and angelic that they don't even have to exchange. That they are necessarily making the world a better place because they are the ones in charge and they just care and they love and they're the greatest people in the world. And if there were ever any misaligned incentives or human nature that was bad, it is excused in them. They are the ones that don't have that bad human nature. Those are the ones that don't get, you know, influenced by power. Because obviously, without them, how would we stop all the evil people in the private sector? How would we stop evil Amazon from shipping things to our houses and making us products? If we didn't have our benevolent politicians to nanny and micromanage every single thing that we did all the time. And of course, occasionally give $100 billion bailouts to a couple of giant conglomerates and give $1,200 to the rest of us just so that we'll shut up and play along. And just to reinforce the idea that this is at the benefit of a ruling class, this is the benefit of a tiny minority, and necessarily cannot equal, that no way will the population get the same sort of benefit because it's a parasitic institution. Think about the difference. Like, we'll just go back to, just because I know it off the top of my head, is General Motors. Back in 2009, 2010, when they got their bailout during the previous crisis, they got bailed out. And remember, none of the normal people got their $1,200 check last time. And that's why I think they had to this time, is because the parasite's grown so much bigger and because there's going to be vast political unrest. The cost being paid by the population is so huge this time around that they cannot cover it up. Like, there would be riots in the street otherwise. But they got away with it last time. Now, just think maybe we could get like a bailout of the wealthy, a proportional bailout. That's the key. General Motors, GM, got a $50 billion bailout. $50 billion. Do you want to guess how much GM was worth in like 2009, 2010? About $50 billion. Is $1,200 the net worth of the average citizen? Is $1,200 your net worth? Because that's how much you got. If GM got bailed out for their net worth, what, isn't this equal? Isn't this us? Aren't we representing ourselves? This isn't hush money, right? Another reason why it's so important that money be just, that money be, you know, compassion, that they're just so nice, that they made sure that we didn't lose our jobs and that those companies didn't go out of business. They saved us. And we should feel guilty for keeping our money. We should feel guilty. Remember, we destroy the economy. We're bad for retail, and we need more consumerism. If we save money, we're destroying the economy. We're terrible things. The models all say it would be disaster if more people saved and actually made their lives better, made their lives more secure and more prepared for an uncertain future. The more risk you take, the more liability you put in somebody else's hands, and the more value you give to other people and make your situation weak, oh, but you make us all collectively stronger. And don't worry, we will bail out all of our giant wealthy conglomerate cronies, and they will keep you employed. Employed, in debt, fragile, and dependent on us. There is no way to make the political means $1 more relevant without destroying a dollar worth of productivity, a dollar worth of real value. In fact, you probably destroy more because you destroy the hope and the confidence in whoever you stole from. It creates distrust between people. It disincentivizes the very nature to stay alive, to produce, and to make things better for ourselves. The most insidious of all of it, in my mind, is the idea that we should feel guilty for producing for ourselves, that savings is bad, and that everything the government does is altruistic, that they're just out to save us, and they just want the correct solution, and it doesn't matter that it just takes them having more money and more control. It's just a coincidence. And take this back to what I said at the very beginning, that this is all just in our heads. These are the means by which human nature absolves themselves of guilt and explains away terrible things that we do. We come up with back justifications. We excuse it. We say, oh, he deserved to be punched because look how stupid he is. Oh, he deserves to have all of this stolen from him because look how much he has versus how much I have. It's the collective exploitation of our own tendency to avoid responsibility for what we do and what we think and how we act towards other people. And by making the very institution bigger, you're excusing the behavior in more and more people. You're giving them a greater and greater out to express that and get away with it, to get awards, to get patted on the back, to get cheered when you just tell people exactly what they want to hear and never give them a hard truth, never have to face reality, responsibility, or accountability for any of our actions. And therein lies why I think Bitcoin is Bitcoin protocols, tools of self-defense are the key, because it needs to change the dynamics of the power balance. Going back to the sovereign individual, that this is about whether or not we can technologically secure the individual from the bandits. And it's so hard to imagine what something without, like, we're such linear and not abstract, just concrete thinkers. Just everything has to be straightforward and A, then B, then C. Our capacity to imagine what it would look like without rulers, particularly after we've been indoctrinated to think that the story of history is just that of rulers and governments and all the other billions or trillions of things and changes are practically irrelevant. Just remember who the king was and what date he was put in office and dethroned and all this stuff. Ignore the money, you know, that the money preceded, the collapse of the money preceded all the, you know, the collapse of civilization. There's so many brilliant and rich things in history that are just totally ignored. It's a travesty of our education system. So I don't see how it's going to be, even though all the change has to happen on the individual level, I think largely what we believe and, like, because our ideology is so controlled by other people, that most of us, like just like he says in this piece, that most people aren't really all that concerned with intellectual things. They don't want to do all this hard thinking about philosophy or the meaning of life or large complex systems. They just want to live their lives and be done with it. Like, they don't want to bother with all the nuance. It's hard. It's frustrating. It's uncomfortable to think about. That's why the solution lies in tools. That's why cryptography, I think, is such a powerful tool. And, you know, again, back to the sovereign individual thesis, the thesis of that book, that the dynamics of how easy it is to create, to secure something behind cryptography, and how unbelievably difficult and how much force it takes. Allocated, like, directed force, not ideological. It can't just be a general force. It has to be directed at the person who has the key to that cryptographic system or that cryptographic private key to read that message, to obtain that value. That is not scalable. And because of that, no matter how powerful it is perceived that they are, they lose one of the key asymmetries in the use of violence. Is that it can easily obtain massive amounts of wealth in aggregate from a widespread population. And I think that dynamic is changing. The source of almost all of their purchasing power these days, I mean, look at the bailouts, go back to exactly our situation now. It is the printing press. It isn't taxation anymore. The taxation is hidden. It is an inflation. It is through control of the money supply. the institution of the state has been and continues to lose the asymmetry of the payoff of violence. And the replacement for that was the payoff of controlling and manipulating the money, and they are losing the payoff of that as well. I think Bitcoin is going to play a powerful role in the changing of these dynamics going forward, that we can hold enormous amounts of value that does not exist in any geographical jurisdiction, that cannot be confiscated in aggregate. It must be, you need each individual key because there's no head to chop off. There's no center to control. It destroys the scale benefit of organized violence. So on that, let's close out. This was part one of Anatomy of the State. And I'd also recommend The Sovereign Individual, just because a lot of what I talked about today is covered in that book, and a bunch of fascinating ideas in there about how the state is maintained, why it came about. Expands on a lot of these really interesting ideas. It's just a fascinating book. But we will be getting into part two of Murray Rothbard's Anatomy of the State tomorrow. So don't forget to subscribe. And thank you for listening. I hope this wasn't a little bit too out there for some of you guys. And regardless of what you think about this piece or my explanation and expansion on it, I hope you at least were exposed to something that you hadn't thought of before. Because that's the whole point of all of this, is that, you know, the hilarious irony of the education system is that it claims that it's so important that we're exposed to different ideas and a bunch of different ways of thinking and a bunch of different perspectives and cultures, when that could not be further from the truth of what we actually get. We could not get a more deeply secured monoculture and simplistic singular way of thinking about everything. And the only way we can actually grow or expand or become able to think for ourselves, regardless of what we end up thinking at the end of that, it's more important that we simply hear multiple perspectives. We hear the right questions and ideas that counter our own, so that we can actually come back to maybe even where we originally thought, but see it better, see it more clearer, and be able to defend it against the other ideas out there. We can test it in the real world rather than just blindly accept it. So hopefully, that's a huge part of my goal here, is to just educate, entertain, and, you know, expose new ideas and new questions to people. So thank you guys for listening. Again, we'll be hitting part two tomorrow. Don't forget to start your Swan Bitcoin savings account at swanbitcoin.com. Guys are sponsoring the Audible of the Bitcoin space, and we love them over there. Thank you, Swan Bitcoin, for all that you do. Subscribe, share this out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space. And until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.